This is Dr. Glenn Duns, medical editor with Australian Family Physician, and I'm speaking with Dr. Louise Stone regarding her recent article in the July issue of Australian Family Physician titled Reframing Chaos, which describes the results of a qualitative study of GPs managing patients with medically unexplained symptoms. And thanks for agreeing to speak with me, Louise.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Great. So first question I have is, how commonly do GPs encounter patients with medically unexplained symptoms?
Yeah, look, it's a really difficult question. I guess we always have issues about what medically unexplained means, but certainly over 50% of our patients have at least one symptom that is medically unexplained. But of course, most of those settle by themselves or with reassurance and are not really relevant, I guess, to this sort of discussion. But in terms of serious things that go on for a long time and require significant amounts of treatment, we're probably looking around the 10% mark. Mm-hmm. And then severe disability of patients with, you know, severe somatoform disorders and those sorts of things. Difficult to define again, but you're still probably looking around the 5% mark, I guess, in primary care.
Mm-hmm. And I guess as you were stating in the article, these patients often do end up consuming a large amount of time, and even if they don't represent a significant percentage of the patient population.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's time and frustration. And I think one of the biggest things that came out of my study is just having the privilege, I guess, of interviewing some very experienced supervisors and educators who are very good at articulating what they do, mm-hmm. just realising how little that discourse gets into our literature and how little that gets discussed, I suppose, in the broader community. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary the work that these guys do in managing patients with complex, difficult conditions that require, I suppose, more of a rehabilitation and recovery approach rather than a curative approach. Mm-hmm. And I guess sometimes we don't value that part of our work. And so when we see these patients, it often feels like we're getting nowhere. And that, I guess, is one of the core constructs that came out of the study.
Mm-hmm. And why is having, you refer to diagnostic labels within the article.
Mm-hmm.
Why is having a diagnostic label important for both patients and doctors?
Yeah, well, it's the validation question, isn't it? For two reasons, I guess. One is that we want to feel like we're actually doing something, that we're on slight solid ground rather than just what I would say trawling through the swamp, you know, trying to mm-hmm. make sense of things. We like to have labels because it helps us make sense of what's going on around us and helps us conceptualize how to move forward. But for patients, you know, we often hear the sick role being said in a very derogatory way, you know, patients wanting the sick role for secondary gain reasons. But it's very difficult to go back to your community and say, well, the doctor says there's nothing wrong, even though I'm suffering. It's a very invalidating thing.
Mm.
And one of the things I often say is, you know, there'll never be a fun run to raise money for medically unexplained symptoms. You know,
right.
It's socially not valued.
Yeah.
And it's that lack of value. And these patients can feel, you know, very alone and very lost and often very ashamed. And over time, they get treated with great contempt by their communities in many cases because they're seen as malingering. So I think in terms of names and labels, labels get clutched onto, and if we don't provide a framework or some sort of way of conceptualising their illness, they'll often attach to a label that's quite unhelpful.
Mm-hmm. And so what strategies did you find the doctors use in the absence of an accepted medical narrative?
Yeah, look, I think I've written a previous article about botany and gardening and saying there's a difference between a botanical label that's like a diagnostic category, which are the ones we're taught, and a sort of gardening label, which is describing what's going on. If you ask GPs what's going on, they'll usually give you a narrative and that helps. So, you know, this is an elderly carer who's looking after his frail wife and is overwhelmed, or this is a bloke with a past history of childhood abuse who's, you know, got poverty and homelessness and struggling to keep it together. And those sorts of diagnoses are incredibly important.
Mm.
And I think the way we make sense to things with patients is we tell them stories. We say, look, I think at the moment you're feeling overwhelmed because you've got so much on your plate and you've got all this history of trauma and that sort of affected you. And so now, you know, your body's starting to feel the stress and you're not coping. And so this is what we need to do to try and deal with the stress. So we do use labels, but we use them in a more storied form, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So in a way, we're trying to construct a narrative, an empathic, caring narrative.
Yeah, that empowers the patient and allows us to move into any space. So we try and construct a narrative, and the word stress came out a lot because with stress, most people accept the word stress. It's not sort of, it doesn't have those pejorative overtones of hysteria or somatization. Mm-hmm. But if you say, I think your body's under stress and I think you've had chronic stress because, you know, using that example again, you know, you had a lot of stress when you were a kid because you had all this history of abuse. And then mm-hmm. you've had this stress of managing your finances and you're a single mom and it's starting to take its toll on your body. Mm-hmm. If you give that sort of narrative, then you can tackle the stress in inverted commas with social interventions, psychological interventions, physical interventions, and you can move in that space. Whereas if you call it, you know, irritable bowel syndrome and that's all, so mm. define it with a very medical term, you don't give yourself space to move, and often you'll get that sort of, oh, you think it's all in my head, doctor, don't you? Mm-hmm. Which doesn't help, because then you end up in a very conflicting relationship with your patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that strategy was the managing the need for validation, I think, is what.
Yeah.
What about tolerating uncertainty? That I found very interesting. So, the statement that good GPs need to be able to learn to tolerate uncertainty.
Yeah. Well, you know, Andrew Knight wrote a good paper saying 6% of our patients have rare diseases, and obviously not the same one. But you know, the reality is those patients. You know, I had one of my registrars who I interviewed who had a really difficult situation, a patient with multiple chronic disease and was homeless and all sorts of other issues, and he came in with, you know, abdominal pain, and after about six visits turns out it's a ruptured spleen. Now, you know, she couldn't have picked that, but on the other hand, we have to live with the fact that many of our patients might be walking around with something, and we've just got to tolerate, you know, what we can't investigate everybody on the assumption that we might find the something underneath. And I think that's quite a hard thing to learn to live with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's difficult because we feel responsible when something odd turns up that we didn't see.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the problem is with if we investigate everyone or over-investigate people, then there's the potential for iatrogenic harm, and we're trying to...
Yeah. Well, both ways. Iatrogenic harm in that you can cause harm, obviously, by doing the procedure, but also you entrench the idea there's something physically wrong. Mm-hmm. So the more investigations you do, the more a patient feels like there must be something serious or the doctor wouldn't be looking. And if you don't find anything, mm-hmm. the assumption is, well, the doctor didn't look hard enough or didn't know where to look, or House would have known what to do, you know, that sort of assumption. So the iatrogenic harm is both ways. Can cause self harm as well as physical harm, I guess.
Yeah. Another strategy that you mentioned was agreeing with the patient that they're suffering and then accepting the responsibility for management.
Yeah, that's obviously not a new concept. We do that all the time, but we do see still those patients, which, you know, Michael Balint in the 50s talked about the collusion of anonymity. You know, patients who just get passed around from specialist to specialist to specialist, and no one owns them. And I mean, ownership sounds like a very sort of authoritarian word, but I guess what the GPs meant was someone has to take responsibility and say, this is my problem and I'm not going to just keep flicking that patient off and flicking them around the circle. And I guess, you know, taking a breath and saying, right, I'm going to take ownership, even though I know this is difficult and I know it's unfixable and I know that, you know, it's going to make me feel uncomfortable and that interpersonally often it's a real challenge. You know, someone's got to own these patients because otherwise they are harmed.
Mm-hmm. And I think the final strategy that was mentioned was shifting the focus from curing to coping.
Yeah.
Again, that's could you describe that a bit more? Or?
Yeah, I guess that's common in chronic pain, isn't it, where you start looking at, you're not going to get rid of the pain, we're going to look at coping. But I guess the idea of coping and looking from a psychological point of view is a bit threefold. It's, you know, the sort of practical strategies for coping, so making sure that patients have got good nutrition and doing what you can to stabilise their medications, all that sort of stuff, but also putting structures in place to support them emotionally. And sometimes that's seeing you every fortnight and touching base, and, you know, and you're performing almost not a palliative role, but a harm minimisation role. You're just holding these patients because they're chronically severely damaged. They've got long-term issues, and you know it's unfixable. So that form of assistance with coping. And I think sometimes also having the hard conversations that no one else is prepared to have. So, mm-hmm. you know, yes, your suffering is ignored in the community, and that's really hard. And, it's a real struggle for you, isn't it, when, you know, you go home to your mum and she says, just pull your socks up and get on with it, and doesn't understand. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's those sort of validating statements that are part of it as well, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I think introducing those early and gradually putting more of an emphasis on them without saying we're not going to try and cure this, but mm-hmm. to say, you know, using words like improve or stabilize or help you manage, or rather than let's see if we can fix it, I think is actually really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that general practitioners often had to separate their role as a counselor and as a clinician?
It varied. For the GPs who did psychotherapy and took out specific sessions for psychotherapy, some of them divided the role. So some of them said, I want you to go and see X for your physical health and I'll look after your emotional health. And I've got to say, personally, you know, I'm very careful. I have a lot of patients with a past history of sexual abuse. So I'm quite careful whether or not, for instance, I do pap smears with a patient where I'm discussing their childhood sexual abuse issues, because I don't want to trigger anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you separate those roles. Sometimes they're separated at consultation to consultation. So today I want to talk about this, and next week I want to talk about that. But I guess one of the special things we have, because we're not physicians or psychiatrists, is that we're able to move. And that's actually a real gift that we have, that we're able to introduce ideas about how tough life might be at the moment and how getting your diabetes so unstable must be really frustrating, and opening up those conversations and letting people vent a bit that perhaps we wouldn't be able to do if we were focused on the, you know, the subspecialty disease.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's value in integrating, but there's also that value in focusing on one thing at a time, because one of the participants said, I've been burned both ways, you know, I've missed psychological things because I'm focused on the physical and the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is really tough.
Yeah. And what conclusions can we take from the study, and what are the implications for general practice?
Well, I think one of the conclusions that we should take away is that GPs do a very good job,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
managing these patients. And these patients aren't often fixable, in inverted commas. They do have long-term chronic harm and long-term chronic issues, and it's unrealistic to expect that we're going to wave a magic wand and all will be well. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, we see these GPs who are holding these patients empathically and helping them live the best that they can, in the same way they would with someone with chronic rheumatoid. And, you know, I think one of the conclusions that I would reach is we need some of those stories to get to the registrars, because I think the registrars come out of hospital expecting that really the gold standard is the diagnosis, and then you find the evidence-based guideline and you're done, you know, whereas in general practice that doesn't necessarily happen, and certainly with these patients it doesn't happen at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I think getting GPs discussing these cases with registrars and opening them up and
mm-hmm.
and really, you know, accepting that actually they're doing quite well, because I think they often don't get very positive feedback around these patients at all, and they, you know, really struggle. So I think that's probably the biggest conclusion is that some of the stories that the senior doctors are constructing about these patients are really would be very helpful for the registrars to hear.
Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes GPs will find that these patients can be the most rewarding as well.
They said that. They absolutely said that. And the ambivalence is, I had the best quote was one of the guys who captured it beautifully. You know, we do struggle. These other patients often are difficult, but on the other hand, they can be quite rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, they do stick on to you. They're like rust.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, you know, and yet, he was one of the people who said, you know, I stay with this patient because it's my job, and he'd been there for 20 years. So
mm-hmm.
I think, yes, they are rewarding. Yes, they are difficult. And we are, as a profession, very good at this, and it's something we should be probably celebrating a little bit more than we do, because
mm-hmm.
I think we tend to see them as not as failures, but as things that we don't manage, when in reality,
mm-hmm.
you know, we are harm minimizing as best we can and trying very hard to validate these people. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think the registrars need to hear that.
Yeah. And are there any future studies that you would like to, or you could see performing on this particular topic? Or different new areas for research, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'd be really interesting to do patient-doctor dyads and interview the patient and the doctor. I think that would be nice to find out what's going on. And of course, I only ask doctors what they think. I didn't see what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it would be very nice to actually look at what they do in practice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a lot of silencing around this stuff, and I don't think we really know what's done because these patients don't fall into categories. And so when we run an ALM on diabetes, we don't talk about them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would be nice to sort of see what doctors do in practice. And to be a bit frank and honest about the fact that we do feel pretty ambivalent about them, and we do struggle sometimes that they do challenge us, and that's sometimes quite hard.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for agreeing to speak with me, Louise, regarding your excellent article.
Thank you. Thanks again. Thank you very much.